From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guests are filmmakers who I think have a particular distinction in the way they work. You look at the films they've done as writers, such as Horrible Bosses, or their great directing work on The Vacation reboot, or even on Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2, or their first film, the film I think really works for them as filmmakers, a new film, is Game Night. So they tend to make comedies about jealousy. Am I wrong, fellas?
No, I think that's an ongoing theme. I think we're very jealous people, generally.
Well, going for, let me introduce my guests to you today, John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein. But that really is, at some point, jealousy just sort of like foams up and almost overtakes your protagonist, doesn't it?
Well, I think it's a classic driver of comedy. If somebody feels inadequate, they are trying very hard to prove themselves to the world or the people in their lives, and they often fall on their faces. And I think that's true of a lot of our characters.
Yeah, I think there's something inherently funny in someone's desperation. And the more desperate they become over the course of the film, the greater lengths they're willing to take to make things right for themselves. And that often results in, you know, disaster.
It's also, that gives us a way to really ground comedy in reality, because what you guys do is kind of broad, but there are real physical stakes in these pieces, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, it's always important for us because to us, I think the best comedy lives in our world, at least to a certain extent. There are touch points where it doesn't feel like you've gone into a heightened universe, but rather the stakes are real. The people around our characters are real. We tried to do that in Game Night, where there's real danger for them. If they take the wrong turn, they can be killed, and it's not that funny. And that was a very deliberate effort to make this as much thriller as comedy.
I think just caring about your characters is sometimes more important than what they're saying or the comedy that they're inhabiting. With Spider-Man, what we tried to do was give Peter Parker a voice that teens could actually relate to and not make him this brooding hero who you can't really sink your teeth into because he's already surpassed that sort of getting to know his own powers stage.
And there again, you know, you talk about jealousy. I mean, Peter Parker desperately wants to be embraced by the Avengers. He's got Tony Stark, Robert Downey Jr. as his would-be father figure, and he just wants to be accepted by them. He's jealous of all that they have, and his arc through that movie is coming to terms with the fact that, no, it's okay to be Peter. He doesn't just have to be Spider-Man and throw off his teenage identity.
But he also wants to be taken seriously, too, by his classmates. I mean, there's that thing, too, where there's that anxiety that I think you guys are really so good at tapping into.
Absolutely. And it's funny because you're dealing with very different stakes. When you're in a high school setting, it's not life or death, whereas outside of school it is. And so you have to make the seemingly lesser stakes just as important. And often it is important because it's more relatable than when they're, you know, fighting on skyscrapers.
Yeah, John Hughes had the luxury of just telling stories about high school kids dealing with high school problems. We had to then inject this world-threatening villain into the mix and still have you care about the John Hughesian-sized issues.
But also by bringing the Vulture really down to earth. I mean, he's jealous, too. I mean, he's a character I really think was being eaten alive by jealousy in the way that, you know, Colin's character is, or yeah, Kevin Spacey. These guys who have sort of have something but never have enough.
Right, right. Well, there's always, it seems to be, a parallel between our hero and our villain where they both kind of start from the same place and then veer off in very different directions.
And yeah, and we talked, you know, a great deal with Marvel about this being kind of a ground level, entry level superhero movie where the villain was not seeking world domination. He wanted to provide for his family and he was doing it in a criminal way. But it was important to us that he be relatable and sort of real.
And justified,
yeah.
But there's also, too, in the movies you guys write, there's almost a class distinction between people. I mean, the people who have money are never happy, and those who want the money aren't happy either. But there's still that line that's kind of drawn the sand between these people, isn't it?
We always talk about the scene where they go into the mansion and the music starts playing. Da 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 da. You know,
that's trope.
That's the sort of cliched version. But you're right. I mean, in Horrible Bosses, they break into Kevin Spacey's mansion. In Game Night, they end up up in Danny Houston's mansion. There is some of that.
And even just the jealousy between Jason Bateman and his brother, where he's jealous of not only his financial state, but his success as a human being on this earth.
And I think that's, you know, going back to the Marx Brothers, there's always been that sort of, in comedy, the love of the sort of lowly, lower class and the, you know, the rich people. And it's kind of fun to make fun of the rich people. There's something liberating in that, I think, for a lot of audiences.
It's funny, though, because with you guys just thinking about your work and looking at this stuff, there's almost like a social commentary aspect on all this, in that, you know, having stuff doesn't make you any happier than anybody else.
Certainly. I mean, it's really how you look at it. And I mean, it's an ongoing theme that I think is more prevalent now than it was before Trump was elected, where there's clearly a distinction and a valuing of things that were generally seen as clearly the wrong way to look at the world.
Well, Game Night is sort of a study in that, where Brooks, the older brother character played by Kyle Chandler, is seen by Max, Jason Bateman, as this sort of aspirational figure, the perfect man who has all this money and success, and he travels the world and he's got a glamorous career. And over the course of the movie, we quickly find out that he's not what he appears to be, and the trappings of success were all sort of illusory. And ultimately, Bateman's character has to embrace that what he has is pretty good and to stop striving for this imagined sort of success.
You guys let the audience know what Game Night's about here.
Sure. It's Jason Bateman and Rachel McAdams play a couple who have a weekly game night with their equally competitive friends at their house. And on this particular weekend, Jason's brother, who Jason has always been very jealous of because he's been more successful and cooler and hipper, and as Rachel McAdams' character says, hotter. he suggests that he kind of hijack their game nights and do one of his own, and it ends up being a murder mystery party where one of them is going to be taken, and over the course of the night they have to figure out who the killer is or the kidnapper is before the victim is killed. And it becomes very clear by the midpoint of the film that Jason's brother was not at all who we thought he was. He is a criminal, and when he was taken, it wasn't part of the game.
I was talking to you, Jonathan, before we got started. This is a really lovely visual motif where a lot of the stuff we see with the cars, like miniatures, this is really like you bring a visual game board into the whole sort of tableau. Talk about where that came from.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we were trying to do is minimize physically our characters as much as we can, so that it's seen from the perspective of someone playing a board game. And we did that in a number of ways, one of them being this tilt shift photography style that we did for our establishing shots, where we used a drone and shot it as though it was a miniature. And so it gave the impression that the cul-de-sac that they lived on was sort of the game of life.
And you know, obviously trying to suggest that our characters in the movie are themselves pawns in a game that they're not aware is being played. Another thing we did was this thing called an R1 arm, which attaches to the back of a vehicle and extends 20 feet up. And what it does is it's a mount, so it moves exactly with the car, and then you digitally remove the mount. And the effect is as if you're watching a video game,
like
one of these driving games.
Like a third-person shooter.
And it really, it's another sort of evocation of game playing.
It was something that I had seen done only once before in, funny enough, a Zack Snyder movie, Dawn of the Dead. And it was just one shot when she's escaping her neighborhood. And I thought it was the coolest thing. And he only used it once in that movie. And I thought, I wonder how far we can go back with this rig, if we could actually see the entire car. And it is technically possible and hasn't really been done before in that particular way. So it's kind of gratifying.
We even took it to the next level. And there's an overhead shot of the jet at the end of the movie that was digital, but it's mounted. It's an homage to the Zodiac, the shot Fincher did in the Zodiac, where the car's turning and the camera's mounted impossibly to the car 100 feet below.
As though it's like a 300-foot mount.
Well, that's interesting, too, because what I find so fascinating about this movie is that you talk about the grounding of it, and there's not a lot of light I mean, so it's almost, it's shot like it's a, like an 80s noir almost.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that was absolutely the intention. And just throwing back to the films of the 80s that take place all in one night, like After Hours.
Risky Business.
We got Cliff Martinez, who is known for his sort of retro-sounding synthetic scores.
That's the score he did for The Nick.
Exactly. The Nick was, I mean, that I wrote a pilot to that score because I thought it was just so immersive. And also you can kind of not be distracted by it. You know, it sets a mood and doesn't go much beyond that. And I thought that what he did with that film was, or with that show, was so incredible.
And we were very clear with Cliff that we didn't want this to be comedy music. And he wasn't really a guy who did comedy music, so it was kind of nice. We just said, treat this like a Soderbergh movie. Treat it like any other piece you've done. And he really embraced that. And so the effect is very, very strong. You often, the audience is not quite sure what the tone is, which was intentional. We wanted them to be uneasy. Is this a comedy? Is this a thriller? And every decision we made in shooting it and lighting it, the color desaturation we did after we shot it, was all meant to sort of evoke a thriller. Our production designer, Michael Kornblith, who has mostly done Ron Howard's movies and was the most grounded, brilliant guy, he had a great line. He said, if you watch this movie in the future on television with the sound off, you shouldn't know that it's a comedy. And that's really how we approached every look, every moment in the movie.
We're very much of the mindset that you don't have to look funny to be funny. And I find that with a lot of comedies these days, they're brightly lit. The characters are wearing solid, bright colors like red sweaters, yellow sweaters. And I think the intention is to just add a little extra comedy to something that might not be necessarily working.
It's like they don't trust the material enough. They have to have a visual cue that this is a comedy. We ran in the opposite direction.
Without really knowing if it was going to work with audiences too. I mean, we were terrified when we did our first test screening because we had no idea if it would actually land with them or if it would just feel like, as people have quoted, a feathered fish. So it was a bit of a toss up, and fortunately people really seemed to like it when they saw it.
But part of that too has got to be, in the grand scheme of things, just putting the audience in the same place with the characters, where there's a constant state of sort of confusion and truth is muddled for everybody. So that being the case, the audience should be, in visual terms, in the same place as the characters, right?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think that the first 2, 3, 4 minutes of the movie play fairly traditionally like a romantic comedy, and then they pull into their driveway and they meet Jesse Plemons, who plays their neighbor Gary, and it suddenly becomes a very different movie.
Well, John, given your background as an actor, you've got to know that the idea of like sort of pushing the science of the box succeeds with audiences in a way that sometimes executives don't get.
Oh, absolutely. You're talking about Garth Ants here?
Wow.
Because
well,
I am.
Throw some shade.
Yes.
No, that's absolutely right. And you should never assume that the bosses know necessarily everything or what they're talking about. But that said, I think we went into it pushing for an emphasis on the genre mashup that we were going for in terms of the marketing. And to their credit, they were receptive and have been kind of leaning, obviously more largely in the comedy side, but also to a certain extent in the thriller. So people do know that there's, you know, something a little bit different about this movie.
And the studio was actually quite supportive. They saw what we were trying to do. They recognized that it was different. Guys like Cliff Martinez, some of the casting choices we made are not at all obvious when you're talking about a new line comedy.
And there was never any point when we were pitching them to the guys that they said, oh, this is too weird. They said, you know, we trust you. Go for it.
I was even afraid, up until the last color timing, I was afraid they were going to come in and say, it's too dark. You got to brighten this all up. Turn it all up. But they never did.
I mean, that's to the credit of New Line, is that they do take a lot of chances and are willing to go outside of the box with things like this, especially if the budget isn't too high.
Well, you got it done. We're going to take a break and see if we can come back with a little more slander. My guests are John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein, the directors of Game Night. It's a treatment this morning. Come stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm talking to the filmmakers behind the funny and intense new film, Game Night, John Francis Daley and Jonathan Goldstein. One of the things I was going to say before the break, and it's this thing that you guys play with a little bit, I think, in Vacation, is that idea of a constant physical threat, which basically sort of trades on the same tension that comedy does. But rather than it being slapsticky, even though that movie is, there's real danger. You guys never even when this stuff is played for broad comedy, there is still a physical threat in the kind of comedies you guys make, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's all about playing with the building of tension and the release. And comedy and thriller are more alike, I think, than people even know. What we noticed when we were test screening, we had cameras trained on the audience to generally just figure out where the laughs were and what jokes weren't working. But something that we realized were it was almost more gratifying when they were gasping with shock, because that's when you really know that you've got them.
Yeah, I mean, some of my favorite films are the ones where the rug is pulled out from under you in such a dramatic way that it shifts the entire movie. In Horrible Bosses, for example, the moment where Kevin Spacey shoots and kills Colin Farrell, it's such a shock because you thought, well, that's a big actor. They're not going to actually kill that guy this early in the movie, but they, you know, we did, and it's a lot of fun. And similarly, I think in Game Night, you know, the stakes when she shoots him in the arm and she's got to remove the bullet, like it's real stuff. It's real pain. And it makes the comedy pop even more, I think, because it's a release, like John said, that you get the audience feeling very sort of tense for these characters, and then you give them a joke so they can let that tension out.
Well, one of the scenes that really is emblematic of what you guys are talking about is the scene where, I don't want to give too much away, the couple is talking about sort of an affair that or that one of them has, and as it's sort of played out, the audience, at least I can say, I said, oh no, this... she really doesn't know, does she? And I was wondering how far you're going to go with this. And you go as far as I think you're going to. And it's that balancing of what's comedy and what's melodrama. And it's kind of both, but they're both reliant on tension.
Right, right. A lot of it depends on how the characters kind of react to those moments, because you could go in a much darker realm where...
And the movie itself is so dark that becomes part of the tension too.
It is a constant challenge. But yeah, in terms of that scene, you know, that was something that we had been working on to make work for a long time, and ultimately we ended up reshooting it. The reveal of the person that she had slept with when they were on a break was much different from what it ended up being.
We didn't even leave the room; it was just done in dialogue, and we realized there was no amount of dialogue that was going to pay off that runner. We had to go out of that room and do a flashback, which was not entirely in the language of the movie, though there was an earlier flashback with, you know, Ryan and his dates. So it felt like, okay, we can do it here. But when you build up something for 45 minutes in a movie, people want to feel, you know, you want to really get that payoff or it's not satisfying.
It also offers that sort of sense of a little bit of the breaking of the tension, because the movie, it's so intense. I mean, it does really play like a thriller as much as anything else. And so I was wondering, and I was going to ask about that scene, because it actually gives the audience a chance to breathe for a moment. But then you introduce a whole other kind of tension into that, right, which sort of cranks it right back up immediately.
Well, our favorite thing, I think, is when you can do both simultaneously. Like, there's that long sequence, which is a oneer, or looks like a oneer, where they're being chased with that Fabergé egg through the house. And that is a very tense thing with scary guys chasing them. But
that's
it's
also
a lot of fun.
Farce stuff, too. I mean, it's literally farce, so people like slamming doors and running out of rooms. You don't get more old school Fado farce than that.
It's Blake Edwards-y, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, we wanted it to be as much a ride as it is a movie, and that was one of our opportunities to go for it. Because you know, in the script, when we had written that sequence, it was one line saying what follows is a hot potato like chase with the Fabergé egg through the house, and that was it. And we took it upon ourselves to really push the envelope and challenge.
It became a day and a half of shooting and out of order because of actor availability. So someone would throw the egg to someone who was on a plane to New York already because we had shot their stuff the day before.
So we really created a headache for ourselves in doing that.
But it's still kind of it's that thing I'm talking about, introducing a physical threat.
Right.
Into a comedy.
Right.
And that's, for me, it's almost like a signature thing for you guys to do.
Yes, and that is on the gross side of danger. And I think in Game Night it was more on the, you know, the dire circumstances that they're dealing with.
And the shock value, because we've spent so long building up to this thing, and then we suddenly take away that thing.
In a seemingly meaningless scene where it shouldn't have happened in that moment. And that's kind of the fun of it, is like finding the shock, because there are ways to have some kind of indication of what's going to happen, and suddenly people know.
Yeah. I mean, Hitchcock spoke about playing the audience like a piano, and that's just the fun of filmmaking. If you can lead them down a road, they think they've gotten ahead of you, and then you turn it around on them.
It's funny you say Hitchcock, because there is that kind of comedy about class distinction, and also the idea of having comedy in a thriller that actually brought Hitchcock to mind a couple of times for me. All the stuff, the first chase scene in the car, it felt very much like, well, they're trying to figure out what's going on.
And
it's like, where are your priorities
in
this? Because people do want to make sense of things. And these are characters who are trying to figure out. For them, like, life is almost like rules, like a game anyway. So where do these rules fit in and where do they not?
Yeah, I mean, we made the conscious effort not to make the action comedic, because then it would only hurt the stakes of what they're dealing with. We have one joke in there, because it just kind of came naturally as we were writing the scene. But otherwise, we really wanted it to play purely like an action movie and not like an action comedy where the action doesn't look very good.
But the other thing that happens too a lot in this movie, I should say, or doesn't happen, and I mean, we're used to it in comedies or movies with a lot of characters, people constantly explaining themselves. That doesn't happen so much here.
Right.
Did you constantly sort of dial back so we're getting information as the characters are getting it?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, we didn't want to spend a lot of time on exposition. We did throw in a line where we first meet the group together, and Billy Magnuson's character said, we used to work together toward the Jason Bateman character, just because we kind of wanted there to be something out in the ether about what are these people doing together.
But it's literally over dual dialogue where other people are talking, and so it kind of gets buried.
But that's one of those things, like, I don't care. If I go to a movie and I'm enjoying the characters, I'm not asking, why are they friends? Why are they hanging out together?
I can't tell you what the villain plot of the last 15 Bond movies were, but I can say that I enjoyed them. That's not to say that you are relying on people to be confused throughout our movie, but we definitely didn't want to spoon feed them with exposition.
We did. We buried the exposition in that car chase you were talking about, where we're learning about, okay, this is who Kyle is and what his background is. And if you're paying attention to it, great. But if you're caught up in the action,
it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
Because when we talk about this, I guess I was thinking too that you guys also like write entrances. Like, there's a big entrance written for Colin in Horrible Bosses.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Brooks gets a big entrance here. I mean, a huge entrance. This literally a disruptive entrance, mm-hmm. which sort of also symbolizes who and what he is as a character to his brother Max, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. We wanted him to have the music blaring and doing everything that goes against what Max had specifically asked him not to do when he introduces himself.
We put the Billy Joel song in, or Captain Jack plays as his arrival music, and it's we didn't think we'd actually be able to afford it, but
we wanted the most anthemic intro to this character that's just larger than life and not real, which is fitting because he ends up not being really.
It's fun in a movie like this to build the anticipation of the arrival of someone, you know, sort of the waiting for Godot kind of a thing, where you hear about this guy for a while before you meet him because he's so important to the main character, and you want the audience to feel a little touch of what the characters feel before he actually makes his entrance on screen.
There was talk at some point of actually introducing Brooks in the form of a flashback way early in the script phase, where we can see right off the bat what their dynamic is and why, you know, he feels bullied by his older brother. And we thought that felt too keeping in line with like a traditional comedy where you set up right away what the relationship is, and suddenly there's no mystery or allure to the character.
We're talking Beckett with the directors of Game Night.
And Hitchcock.
And Hitchcock, of course, John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein. But what you guys are doing so much is playing with genre in ways that people don't really do with comedy. There's a time when that happened as often as not, where people use comedy as almost like a Trojan horse to do other kinds of things. And now broad comedy is really just about finding a way to do like the biggest, in some ways, grossest joke and not have it relate to anything else.
Yeah, I mean, we're consumers of comedy. We have been all our lives. And it would be a disservice to not sort of include our knowledge of comedy films into the making of our films. That is to say, you never want the audience to be thinking something disparaging and not have sort of called it out before they did.
Yeah.
For example, at the end of, in the third act of Game Night, Bateman is doing a charades thing to sort of get them out of this dire situation. And we have him say that's some cute full circle bullshit. But he's recognizing what hopefully the audience is, which is that this is sort of a trope we're playing with in how comedies usually work.
And fortunately, we can get away with it because the characters are so knowledgeable of pop culture and trivia that it feels natural that they would understand a trope, a movie trope, because they've seen a lot of movies and know the answers to a lot of trivia questions.
But that also comes into play in some ways in Spider-Man and Horrible Bosses. So many things take place. They're like almost Hitchcockian in that way, that we're waiting for some big scene that, or a big scene happens in a room where everybody's trapped, mm-hmm. and there's kind of an exchange of power.
Oh, yeah. Well, our favorite scene in Homecoming was the moment toward the end where Michael Keaton is driving and Peter Parker's in the back.
And he already knows that the father of his girlfriend is the villain that he yeah. has been trying to fight, but he doesn't know for sure if the villain knows that he is Spider-Man. And so it's a fun push and pull of them kind of weighing each other out and figuring out what they know about the other person.
And that was very sort of Hitchcock-inspired. I mean, Dial M for Murder. There's all these great moments where the audience knows something, the character doesn't, yet one of the characters does, and you're just waiting for them to catch up, and there's that tension of, oh, no. And so that was a real fun one.
Not only that is it that, but it's also a classic old-school like Stan Lee, Steve Ditko sort of Spider-Man moment. So it mm-hmm. felt like it was really one of these things where, as a consumer of all these things myself, it brought so many of these threads together. It was really exciting to watch.
It was also a nod to the John Hughes 80s movies where, you know, the villain is the father of the girl that you're trying to court. And in this case, he's not just a strict dad. He's truly the super villain of the film.
But there's also that sort of thing, too, where, again, you guys are pressing so often against class distinction. I really wonder where that comes from for you, because that's so often. I mean, we see that with Rusty, even in Vacation, this idea of class being this wall between mm-hmm. people that they're trying to get out of.
It's true, they grew up working class.
Yeah, we both grew up. My parents were teachers. And
I don't know if that informs it at all, but I think definitely it is a relatable mindset to sort of envy, you know, what you don't have.
Yeah, and it's fun to take the air out of the illusion of wealth equaling happiness. For example, in Vacation, they go to where Chris Hemsworth and Leslie Mann are living, and it quickly becomes clear that their marriage is not what it seems, that he's a weirdo, walks around in his underpants, and, you know, there's all this dysfunction just below the surface. Kevin Spacey in Horrible Bosses was cheating on his wife right and left.
It's almost more important what these successful people are projecting to outsiders than it is how they actually feel in their lives. Because what our protagonists are jealous of is something that isn't actually real, is something that the people that they're jealous of are putting out there to kind of protect themselves in a weird way.
Well, I just thought one of the things that draws you to comedy is there's so much you can do in subtextual terms that can make it more than comedy. And you guys have done this pretty often.
I think that's what's appealing to us, is finding something relatable in the film, because, you know, otherwise you don't quite sure know why you care about any of the characters.
Yeah, look, there's plenty of hilarious movies that aren't anything below the surface, Airplane or, you know, any number of Monty Python. Monty Python usually had something to say, but we find that generally it's more resonant and more lasting if the movie's about something other than just getting as many laughs as you can.
We're out of time. I'm sorry. You guys got to come back. We have plenty to talk about, clearly.
We'd love to. Thank you.
Thanks so much. My guests are the directors of the intense and pretty complex comedy Game Night. They, of course, are John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein. The show is recorded at NPR West by Patrick Murphy. It's mixed by Kat Yore, edited by Blake White, who's associate producer. I'm not Kenny. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.